Welcome to Scientifica, the premier podcast where the latest scientific discoveries are discussed in the context of their apologetic significance to the Christian faith.
This is Average Joe Aguirre, joined today by members of our scholar team, astronomer Hugh Ross, biochemist Fuzz Rana, and molecular biologist A.J. Roberts. Astrophysicist Jeff Zwirnk is off fishing, I guess, or what's he doing? Guys, on vacation of some kind?
Yeah, I think he's gone fishing in the Gulf Coast with his brothers and his dad.
Doing that again. Okay.
Doing that again, right.
We won't feel too sorry for him. They will be sharing the exciting research from the front lines of the scientific journals and discussing the apologetic implications. You will hear from each in roundtable fashion, as usual. Welcome to each of you. We've tossed the dice just prior to the podcast. And the order today is AJ going first, followed by Hugh, and then Fuzz. AJ, you've been doing a lot of summer reading, as you like to do, a book, all kinds of articles. And in this case, regarding genome editing, the CRISPR-Cas gene, CRISPR, in this case, C-R-I-S-P-R, I gather that's...
It's an acronym.
Acronym, okay. With all kinds of exciting implications for some treatments regarding retinitis pigmentosa, possibly even human gut pathogens, may perhaps even anti-cancer therapies. We'll get into all of the implications there, but I know you have apologetic discussions you want to get into as well. We'll unpackage all of that as you go, but... Take us the direction you want to start with, and we'll have some good discussion as we go.
Sure. Thanks, Joe. I thought I would use my time today to just talk about some articles that I've read over the last couple of weeks that have come out over the last couple of months, and all of them have the theme of the CRISPR-Cas system for gene or genome editing. And I've spoken on this before. I've blogged on it. So for those of you that aren't unfamiliar with it, the CRISPR-Cas9 system is one that was first discovered in bacteria, and it's actually part of a bacterial immune system, but it's a system that can be engineered to target specific sequences of DNA and actually alter the DNA at very specific sites by cutting the DNA and either introducing new genetic information or replacing genetic information that might have been flawed or removing genetic information. And it's a way of highly specifically targeting DNA sequences in order to edit them into what you want them to be. And so I'm just going to briefly run through three articles that stood out that sort of show some of the breadth of the application of this technology that's really been exploding since 2012, since the first couple of publications on using it as a genome editing system. But the first one is to treat something called retinitis pigmentosa, which is actually a functional blindness that's caused by destruction of rod cells in the retina. And so the retina is made up of rods and cones, and rods are the ones that detect low light levels. It gives you your vision. It's not a very... It doesn't have very high spatial acuity, but you get some vision, especially under low light levels, due to the rods. The ones that are much more functional in, as far as our visual acuity goes, are the cone cells. And the cone cells in the retina, they function under higher light levels. They give us color distinction, and they give us high spatial acuity. Well, the rod cells outnumber the cone cells by about 20 to 1 in the retina. And this disease... retinitis pigmentosa is a destruction of the rod cells. And so what they've been able to do, well, first of all, the disease is associated with multiple mutations in multiple genes. And so it's not simple to go in and say, there's this one mutation or these couple of mutations in this single gene, let's replace this single gene, because it could be a number of different genes and it could be hundreds of different mutations in any of these genes that are actually leading to the disease. But what they've found is if they target two genes in particular, one of them is called NR1, and it's basically a master control switch that has a lot of downstream proteins or gene products that are controlled by the expression of the NR1 protein. And another one is slightly further downstream from the NR1 master switch signal, and it's called NR2E3. The names aren't really important. That second one is a transcription factor. And basically, the master control switch and the transcription factor are what control an entire network of gene products that cause a particular cone cell or rod cell to differentiate into a cone or a rod. And what they find is if they can shut down the NR1 and the NR2E3, if they can shut down those two things, or either one of those two things, they can basically change a rod cell into a cone cell. And if they change it into a cone cell, it becomes resistant to the mutations that are associated with the disease retinitis pigmentosa. And they can increase the number of cone cells, and they can actually salvage vision. At least they've been able to show this in mice. And so what this shows, by using CRISPR-Cas9, they can target either one of these two genes. And if they target either one, and basically all they have to do is synthesize a small single guide RNA, and they actually make two, so they're targeting two different sites in either the master switch control gene or in the transcription factor control gene, but they're targeting it twice to kind of, you know, for sure, hit that gene hard. But if they're able to knock out either one of these two genes using the CRISPR, in this case, Cas9 system, delivered through adeno-associated virus vectors, then they're able to reprogram the rods into cones and basically show an upregulation of electrical activity of the cone photoreceptors in two different mouse models. And so they're saying that the implication here is we can use this technology of gene editing, even if it's possibly multiple genes or different genes that are creating the disease or different mutations in different genes that are creating the disease, we can treat the disease by targeting just a single gene or another single gene. And if we do that, we have good reason to think that we can have broad application against a class of disease called retinitis pigmentosa.
Is this something that you get tested for when you see an ophthalmologist, retinitis pigmentosa?
I think you probably would be if you started to have vision impairment, right? If you started to have signs of visual loss. So
this possibly could be something.
It affects
mice.
Quite a few people.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
So that's one. And right now that work's been done in mice, but there's good sense that it could be applied to humans as well. All you have to do is deliver that RNA, that protein, through this adenoviral vector, which isn't replicative vector, so you don't have to worry about giving yourself a virus infection. But they basically, in the mice, they just inject it into the subretinal space, which is the space behind your retina, and let it go.
Another reason to thank God for viruses?
Another reason to thank God for viruses. We're going to have lots of those by the end of my time. So the second article that caught my attention was actually kind of a meeting update on the CRISPR 2017 conference that happened earlier in June in Big Sky, Montana. And there they're highlighting three applications using CRISPR-Cas9. And what they're doing in one situation is they're altering phage. Now, if you remember, phage or bacteriophage is a word that's used to broadly describe viruses that infect prokaryotes. So viruses that infect bacteria or viruses that infect archaea. And so here they're trying to address the question of, can we engineer phage to kill bacteria that have become antibiotic resistant? Well, phage will often typically kill the bacteria that they're specifically infect anyway. But if a phage does that, then the bacteria eventually will develop sort of a resistance to that particular phage, the same way that they develop a resistance to antibiotics. So what they're saying is, can we use CRISPR-Cas9 to genetically alter the phage so that when the phage goes into the bacteria, it's not just killing the bacteria, but it's killing the bacteria that have the antibiotic resistance genes in place, right? And so they've engineered the guide RNAs in this case that they introduce into the phage to specifically target the genes that are causing the antibiotic resistance. And so they're kind of getting around this idea of, well, the bacteria can become antibiotic resistance and phage resistance. We're actually going to target those that are antibiotic resistance by targeting that gene. And so kind of, you know, can we give the phage a step up and help us treat antibiotic resistant bacteria? The second way they're manipulating phage, again using the CRISPR-Cas9 system, is to alter the phage to target human gut pathogens. And so they didn't actually articulate which gut pathogens they were targeting because they're a company that wants to make money off their product, I'm sure. But my guess is that they're probably targeting C. diff, which is a bacterial infection that's often life-threatening in people who are hospitalized and become infected with this. And so if they're targeting this particular bacteria, they're obviously going to be targeting a gene that's specific for C. diff. And the third way that they're talking about using CRISPR-Cas9 is to target particular pathogens in our microbiome, right? So remember, we have many more bacteria in our body than we do human cells. And the vast majority
Something
of those...
Something to think about.
Yeah, and the vast majority of those are in our gut, right? They're helping with our digestive system, but they have effects on our physiology broadly and generally, not just on our digestive. And some of the pathogens in our microbiome have actually, in diseased situations, been associated with things such as irritable bowel disease or colitis, some neurological disorders, and even obesity. And so what they're hoping to be able to do is sort of alter through CRISPR-Cas9 technology phage that will destroy particular bacteria in the human microbiome and basically give you a healthy profile, and they might be able to treat diseases like colitis or obesity or some neurological disorders.
More potential good news.
Okay, and the last thing that caught my eye, and this has been in the news the last couple of weeks, is a technology that's being used to target a B cell, leukemia, ALL, and it's a type of T cell that's been genetically engineered to be specific against a cancer antigen that's expressed on the cancerous cells in the B cell cancer. And so they've engineered the T cells, they've taken T cells out of an individual, they've engineered it so that it recognizes the cancer antigen, and they're reintroducing the T cells into the individual and destroying the cancer this way. Well, this just received...
Individual being what? A mouse again? Or?
No. In this case, human beings.
Oh,
and so
okay.
Just 2 weeks ago, I think it was, the FDA panel recommended FDA approval for this type of therapy to be actually implemented and available broadly for people who suffer from B-cell ALL. And the way that they've generated these T cells presently for these current clinical studies that have led to this FDA recommendation for approval is they've used a retroviral vector, and that sort of targets the T cell that they're trying to manipulate to fight against the cancer cell in a non-specific way. And so another set of papers has come out recently, just last month, that suggests that if you use CRISPR-Cas9 to target specific genes in the T cell, you can make that T cell, it's called a CAR T cell, and CAR stands for chimeric antigen receptor. And that's basically saying, well, you've got this chimera that recognizes an antigen. And in this case, the antigen is a cancer antigen that's on the cancerous cell. And so you've designed the CAR T cell to have a receptor that uniquely recognizes the cancer. Well, the way that you introduce that into the CAR T cells using a retroviral vector can be very nonspecific. And although it works, it's shown levels of it's efficacious to pretty high levels. They've found that if you use CRISPR-Cas9 to target direct insertion into a particular gene in the T cell, what they get is they get improved activation of the T cell, so the T cell's activated in a way that makes it recognize the cancer better. They get longevity of that T cell in vivo in the model system, and they get increased efficacy of fighting the cancer. And so they're saying, yeah, what we've got now that's about ready to be approved by the FDA for general use is good, but with a slight modification by making these cells, rather than using a retroviral vector, using CRISPR-Cas9 technology, we can make those T cells even better and more efficacious. So we're hopeful that it does get FDA approval. It's a cancer that affects many pediatrics and young adult population. And in those cases, if it's recurring or relapsing, the five-year longevity of somebody suffering from those diseases is typically less than 10%, less than 30%, somewhere in that range. So this would be really good news. So all of this sort of, this is an amazing technology. That's why I wanted to highlight these things, look at the things we can do with it. I blog about this on occasion. I post about it on Facebook much more frequently. I try to follow the research. And just last month, a couple of weeks ago, a book came out by one of the co-discoverers of this application of CRISPR-Cas9 technology, Jennifer Doudna. From UC Berkeley, and one of her colleagues, Sam Sternberg, have written a book called A Crack in Creation. And they're basically talking about the potential that we have to edit the genomes of pretty much any organism and what unthinkable power this gives us to sort of control evolution. So I've only gotten through the first three chapters of the book, but I've been struck as I've been reading about CRISPR-Cas9, which I've been thinking about a lot lately, as to what it really is. And what CRISPR-Cas9 is, so the CRISPR part, the acronym, stands for clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats. So that's what CRISPR is. and all of that's really kind of important. So it's a stretch of DNA that was found in archaea and bacteria that they have, if you think about the DNA as a string, they have palindromic repeats, which basically means it reads forward the same way it reads in reverse, right? It's kind of like the word mom or the word Bob, right?
Kayak.
Yeah, there you go, kayak. So anyway, if it has these palindromic repeats that are on the string of DNA, sort of like beads. And in between the beads are strict parts of the string. And that parts of the string are the regularly interspaced sequences in between the palindromic repeats. And you have a bunch of them, and they're clustered together with some genes that are called Cas genes, C-A-S, Cas genes. And so this clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats are actually part of a bacterial immune system. And so what happens is when a phage infects a bacteria, proteins in the bacteria, and I think some of them are the Cas proteins, and there's at least 9 different Cas proteins that I'm aware of, 1 through 9. But the Cas proteins can basically cut up the viral DNA, and through other mechanisms, these little pieces of the viral DNA get captured in this clustered array of interspaced sequences with these palindromic repeats in between. And so it's sort of like a DNA memory of a bacteria that's encountered a phage now has a little snapshot of a portion of that phage that it's collected and put into its own DNA. And so when that bacteria that has that phage sequence encounters that phage a second time, its immune system kicks in, and it can actually make an RNA from the DNA that's in its CRISPR region, and that RNA can help the Cas protein to target the DNA or the RNA that's coming in the phage virus. And so it's basically saying, look, I've seen this before. I have a little bit of genetic memory that this was part, that I've been exposed to this before. And I'm going to take that bit of genetic memory, I'm going to transcribe it and use it to attack the virus that's attacking me. And Wow. And so the Cas proteins that are associated with it targeting the virus phage DNA or RNA actually work then against the phage DNA or RNA by cutting it up. And some of the Cas proteins sort of cut it so frequently that they just shred it. Basically, there's no DNA that's in long strands anymore. Or like the Cas9 that they've used to engineer these other technologies, the Cas9 goes in and cuts it on both strands, but it cuts it once. But it's still enough to sort of disable the phage and help the bacteria win the day. So as I've been thinking about this and reading about it, I've just been struck, right? Because I've talked about why would a good God create viruses, and the fact that bacteria are masters of reproduction and masters of adaptability. They can adapt to their environment very quickly at a molecular level. Part of the reasons they have that capability is because they can swap genes through horizontal gene transfer. But bacteria are such fabulous reproducers and such fabulous adapters that if it weren't for phage, I'm convinced that Earth would be one giant ball of bacteria, because they would outcompete, outreproduce, and sequester all of the nutrients that would allow higher organisms to live, which is why we need to be very thankful for the phage virus, because phage keeps bacteria in check. One of the amazing things is that phage, like all other viruses, can't reproduce itself. So here you have this really critical element in creation that's controlling bacteria to make higher level, higher complex organism life possible, but it's being controlled by something that can't replicate it on its own. It can only replicate inside a living cell. Phage, like all viruses, need a living cell in order to make more virus. But if that's true, you have phage that's keeping the bacterial population in control. Why doesn't phage win the day? Well, in about 0.1% of infections, the bacterial immune response saves the bacteria. So you have this incredible balance at the very foundational, fundamental levels of life on Earth, probably the first life on Earth being bacterial 3.8 billion years ago. I think God created bacteria in a diverse manner, diverse populations of bacteria, but he also created viruses, because there's really no sense from where viral origins come from. And the fact that they can't replicate on their own, they need living cells in order to replicate, suggests to me that the 10 to the 31 virus particles on planet Earth, 10 million times more viruses than stars, were part of God's creation too.
Wow.
And finely tuned at the fundamental level so that neither bacteria win the day nor phage win the day. And the bacterial immune system is here to save the day. So that's been my sort of God wow moment, is thank God for bacterial immunity.
Very interesting.
And thank God for viruses.
Yeah.
So.
And thank God for stars, but stars are a lot bigger.
Yeah.
Bigger is not necessarily more powerful in this case.
I have never heard all that, but makes a lot of sense to me. Fuzz, any comment? Hugh?
That's great.
Bacteria and viruses in concert like that. Well, you mentioned at the outset, if I heard you correctly, that we've been at gene editing since 2012 or so?
Oh, no. We've been at gene editing a lot earlier. Yeah, but using this particular technology called CRISPR-Cas technology since about 2012, which is when the first two publications came out that were really saying, look, this, we've identified this bacterial immune system, but look at what we can do with it. Mm. We can edit it. We can target specific sequences, and we can edit those specific sequences.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. So, but they're been, we've known about gene editing.
We've known about gene editing since probably the 1970s. There have been other systems like zinc fingers and something called talons. And actually, Jennifer Doudna talks about sort of the history of gene editing in the first couple of chapters of the book. So anyway, I'm going to be blogging and writing and posting to Facebook more and more about CRISPR-Cas9 technologies and their applications and their challenges, because there are ethical questions that we should start to address and think deeply about. And I think in part that Jennifer Doudna will get to some of those in her book as well. But, you know, now that we have the capability to be editing the human genome, should we? Now that we have the capability to more easily genetically modify crops or other organisms, we have the ability to introduce something called gene drives. Maybe I'll talk about that some other time. But basically to affect entire populations of organisms in very rapid manner through this technology, should we? And what kind of controls should there be? So, join the conversation. If you want to get a copy of the book, we can discuss that on Facebook as well.
Okay.
Interact over it. So,
I think for lay people, viruses make you sick, but these are viruses that make you healthy.
These are viruses that let you live.
Exactly.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Okay. Well, thank you for that. And people can find you on your Facebook page.
And I have a DVD out now, too, on Why Would a Good God Create Viruses?
Right.
So anybody that wants to send in a contribution to RTB this month, you still have a few days left. I think they get a free copy of that DVD if they
half
want.
Half the rainfall and snowfall we get is all thanks to viruses?
Yeah, that's an estimation, but it could be true. It could be an underestimation.
The name of that, again, is
Why Would a Good God Create Viruses?
Okay. Yeah. Available here at Reasons to Believe. Thank you, AJ. Great stuff.
Thanks, Joe.
All right, Hugh. When people think about searching for exoplanets and life and all of that, they think, or at least I think as a layperson, of large telescopes. But according to the article that you handed me, the name of this one is Kilo Degree Extremely Little Telescope. And based on a note that you wrote with your little hand, 1.65 inches. Did I get that? Am I reading that
right? That's
right.
That's how small this telescope is. It's got an aperture of just 1.65 inches.
And you're not pulling my leg.
Nope. I mean, I think this is exciting for lay people because we've been told the bigger the telescope, the greater the discoveries we're going to make. This is an example where you can't do this kind of astronomy with really large telescopes. You have to use a little telescope. And we're talking a telescope that's smaller than a pair of binoculars that you would buy at Walmart.
Wow. So, okay, well, looks like there are two of them, one in Arizona and one in South Africa. Okay.
Yeah, they wanted to be able to cover the entire celestial sphere. So, yeah, you want one in the north and you want one in the south. And so they talk about the Kilo Degree Extremely Little Telescope North and the Kilo Degree Extremely Little Telescope South. I mean, a lot of money is being poured into building extremely large optical telescopes. And I'm not kidding about extremely large. They're as large as radio telescopes are. We're talking telescopes that are 110 to 130 feet across in terms of their collecting mirror. Well, and you know, we're going to get some incredible astronomical discoveries as a result of those extremely large ground-based telescopes. Within the next decade, it's just going to, I mean, it's mind-blowing to think what the James Webb telescope's going to do, but it's going to be complemented by these extremely large telescopes.
And an extremely large price tag, I would
extremely
imagine.
Extremely large price tag. This is another set of discoveries that are going to be done thanks to these extremely little telescopes.
All right.
And yeah, the cost is a whole lot less, as you can imagine.
Okay, well, let's hear about the technology, because I still don't understand, looking into a little thing, how you're going to see
Well, the
stars.
Advantage of having an extremely little telescope, you get a really big field of view.
Okay.
I mean, the bigger the aperture you have, the smaller the amount of sky that you get to see. This extremely little telescope, it's so little that the field of view is 26 degrees across. Which means you get to sample a huge portion of the celestial sphere. And this is a telescope that's targeting the brightest stars in the sky. I mean, the problem with a really little telescope, all you can see are the bright stars. But this is a research program that's focused on only looking at the brightest stars. And the problem, this paper hasn't been published yet. It's a preprint, but I was able to find it on a preprint website. And so it literally got posted just a couple of weeks ago, like I think 8 days ago it got posted. So this is brand new. But 55 authors are on this paper.
Wow.
So can you imagine 55 astronomers getting together to do research on a telescope that's only 1.65 inches across?
Get your nose out of the way. It's as big as the telescope.
I mean, I kind of looked at it and said, do they really need 65 astronomers to collect data from a telescope that tiny? But the reason why so many astronomers are involved, that this is an instrument that's targeting looking for planets around the brightest stars. And this preprint is basically announcing a major discovery. Because
right,
there's been speculation in the astronomical community that the more massive the star, the less likelihood you're going to have planets orbiting that star. And if you do have planets, they're going to be really massive. They're not going to be small planets. And it's something we've noticed is that the small stars are the ones where we're finding multiple planets, but the planets, of course, are small. And so this research is actually targeting, is there a limit whereby a star more massive than a certain mass will not have any planets at all? And is there also a correlation between how many planets you're going to have per star on the average and the mass of the star? And is there a cutoff on how small of a planet you can get based on the mass of the star? And this is only the sixth planet discovered orbiting an A-type star. And for the non-astronomers that are listening, yes, we astronomers categorize stars in terms of their mass and their brightness with letters. And so an O-type star is the biggest star that we see in the universe. And then you have the B-type stars where they're a little bit smaller. Then you got the A stars, the F stars. Our star, the Sun, is a G-type star. So it's kind of like in the middle of the mass range. And then smaller stars would be K-type stars. And the smallest stars of all are the M-type stars. And we know there's a population correlation, that the bigger the star, the fewer of them you have in the universe. And so O-type stars are the rarest stars of all. M-type stars are the most common. Now, if you want to know how to remember all these letters, we astronomers have a sentence that helps us remember. It's, O, B, a fine girl, kiss me. Okay? So O, this B, was,
this
A.
Was before the era of political correctness.
Hey, wait a minute.
Before the era of political correctness.
Yeah, this sentence was formulated back in the 18th century.
O, B, a fine
girl.
Guy.
And kiss okay.
me. There you go. There you go. We just salvaged it. So
you
both
just
genders
salvaged it for both genders. Yeah, okay. That'll work both ways. So thank you, AJ.
That's great.
Anytime. Yeah.
All right. But they've been able to use this extremely little telescope to demonstrate that O-type stars and B-type stars don't have planets. Because basically what this instrument does, it looks at these very bright stars and determines whether or not they ever dim at any time over a period of time. Because if there's a planet that's transiting the star, where the planet and the star are in our line of sight, that planet will cause the light of the star to dim by a tiny amount. Now, in the case of really bright stars, it's only going to dim by, say, one part in 10,000 or one part in 100,000. And so what they've done, the cheap part of this telescope is the actual telescope. The expensive part is a photometer they have in the back end, which very carefully measures the amplitude of the brightness of the star. And what they're looking for is, do we actually see a repeated pattern where the star gets very, very slightly dimmer? If that's the case, we know that there's a planet orbiting about that star in our line of sight. Mm-hmm. And but the fact that they've got a 26-degree field of view means that they can simultaneously observe the brightness of these bright stars. They can get a huge sample because of the fact that it's such a tiny telescope.
Is this somewhere where it's really dark out in the desert somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, they got one telescope in a dark place in Arizona, another telescope in a dark place in South Africa. And so even though the telescope is that tiny, they're able to see these really bright stars at a level where the star has a brightness much less than what the naked eye can detect. I mean, take out a pair of binoculars. What you'll notice is you can see stars 1,000 times fainter than what you can see with a naked eye. And actually, this extremely little telescope has two size features. There's the 4.2 centimeter, which is 1.65 inches. That's where they get the really wide field of 26 degrees. But they got a slightly bigger one where instead of just a 4-centimeter aperture, it's 7 centimeters. But at 7 centimeters, they can only sample 11 degrees. They can't get 26. But with 7 centimeters, they can actually see stars that are another factor of 100 times fainter. And so by looking literally at hundreds of stars simultaneously, they can determine, okay, which kind of stars have planets and which don't. And what they're able to announce in this paper is, the O-type stars and the B-type stars, they don't have planets. The A-type stars very rarely have planets. I mean, look, for 20 years we've been trying to find planets around A-type stars. The list today stands at 6. In fact, what this paper is announcing, we knew of 5, we discovered a 6. But it literally took years for them to make the list go from 5 up to 6.
So as a layperson, I guess I'm thinking it's been difficult because of the brightness of the star to find any planets around these O-type stars.
Well, it's not that difficult.
Oh, it's not?
No, I mean, because These stars are bright, so they're easy to see.
But to find planets?
But what they're looking for is a change in the brightness.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the brighter the star, the less the change. Although what they've noticed is this, is that the brighter the star, the bigger the planets. And if the planet is big, it's going to occult more light. So a Jupiter-sized planet is going to, you know, block out more light of its host star than, say, a planet like Earth. And this is something else they're discovering, is it appears that these really bright stars, they only have big planets. And what they're announcing in this paper, too, is this is the brightest star that's ever been discovered to have a planet orbiting it. But what's interesting is that the planet they found orbiting it is about 3.5 times the mass of Jupiter, so it's a little bit bigger than Jupiter. But it's orbiting so close to its star that the star has literally blown off most of the atmosphere of the planet. And so I didn't see this in the paper, but being an astronomer, I read it. It says, given the fact that the star is about 600 million years old and that the planet is orbiting, it orbits about the star with a period of just 3 days. It's got to be really close to that star. And they do write about in the paper how the ultraviolet radiation coming out of the star is very aggressively ablating the atmosphere of the planet.
What does that mean?
It means it's eroding it, basically causing planet to be evaporated to interplanetary space. But again, being an astronomer and looking at the numbers I saw here, I said, you know, it's amazing this planet has any atmosphere at all, given how long it's been orbiting its star. And maybe what's going on is that this star formed a body that wasn't a planet. It was a brown dwarf. Brown dwarfs are bodies that are like 20 to 50 times the mass of Jupiter. They're actually big enough that they radiate their own light because of their gravitational collapse. And so this kind of would fit the model. The bigger the star, the bigger its planets, the fewer planets you're going to get. And I suspect that this is a planet that began, say, maybe 30 times the mass of Jupiter, but because of its proximity to this very bright star, basically had its mass eroded down to its current 3.5. But what this is telling us, or is confirming for us, is a model of planet formation. The more massive the star, the lower the likelihood it's going to make planets, and what planets it does make are going to be big. And that explains why we're finding so many planets orbiting these small stars, because there is a correlation. I think this is going to help astronomers build more secure models of how planets form. And actually, I think in the bottom line, it's going to actually show us much more fine-tuning in the planets orbiting our solar system. Because our star is a G-type star, the guy or the girl star. And, you know, we have 8 planets orbiting our star. Matter of fact, we know from the dynamics of the solar system that we began with 10 planets. One collided with the Earth, and that made the Moon. The other one was a planet the size of Neptune that got ejected from our solar system, or at least tossed far out into the outer reaches of our solar system. And so that's a lot of planets for a star as big as a G2-5 star. You know, just to kind of tell you, astronomers also have a way of fine-tuning those letters. And so, for example, A-type stars, you can have an A1, A2, A3, A4, all the way down to A9. This is an A2 star. So it's the most massive A-type star that's been discovered to have a planet orbiting it, but it's probably the cutoff point because we've never found a B-type star with a planet orbiting it. So this is, in fact, that's what they announced in the paper. They probably have found the upper limit to a planet's mass where it could still have a planet orbiting it.
A star's mass.
A star's mass. But now we got the problem of how do you explain our G2 star having such a huge system of planets? And, of course, another problem is why does it have planets like no other planetary system? Because believe it or not, the most common mass we find for planets are planets that are 2 to 10 times the mass of our planet Earth. Well, if you look at our solar system, 10 planets, none of them are in that mass ratio. And so we're an enormous anomaly. And trying to explain the anomalous nature of our solar system. But one of the things we've benefited from finding 3,700 planets outside of our solar system, a catalog of exoplanets now reveals to us that every planet in our solar system plays a critical role in making advanced life possible here on Earth. And maybe that's why we've not been able to find a Mars twin or a Venus twin or a Neptune twin. We've not been able to find a planet in any extrasolar planetary system that has the identical features of any one of the eight planets in our solar system. And that's what led my peers to discover, yeah, every planet in the solar system plays a critical role in making advanced life possible here on planet Earth. And you've heard me say this before, when our family celebrates Thanksgiving, we thank God for Neptune, we thank God for Mars and Venus. Matter of fact, we thank God for the five asteroid and comet belts, because they too are belts like no other extrasolar planetary system has. And they have to be exactly the way they are for advanced life to be possible here on Earth. So we also thank God for the Oort cloud and the Kuiper belt, for the main belt, the scattered belt.
Mm-hmm. Food gets cold, but there's lots to be thankful for.
Yeah, my sons have complained a few times. So
Hugh, if I'm hearing you right, one of the things that this paper is doing is it's confirming a model for solar system formation that suggests that, is it called the accretion disk when planets are forming or when the stars forming? But basically, if the star's bigger, it's taking up more of the mass, total mass, that would have gone into the formation of the solar system?
Well, what this paper...
And so you have fewer planets?
Yeah, this paper is basically confirming our best ideas on how ordinary planetary systems form.
Okay.
It's not explaining how our solar system forms.
Okay, so I use using solar system in a general term, but planetary system. Okay.
And what this paper is pointing out is probably the brightness of the star. Because the brightness of a star goes up with the fourth power of its mass. And so, yeah, if you've got a planet that is twice the mass of our sun, or pardon me, a star that's twice as massive as our sun, it'll be 16 times brighter.
Okay.
And so it's the brightness of the star that's challenging planet formation, because you've got this strong ultraviolet X-ray wind coming out of the star, and that's going to seriously disrupt the planetary disk that's forming above the new forming star.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
All right, Hugh, thank you for that. I'm impressed with this kilo degree extremely little telescope.
So, a lot of good astronomy can be done with a really tiny telescope.
With 55 astronomers on hand.
With 55 astronomers on hand, right.
Okay, thank you for that report. All right, let's switch it over to Fuzz. And Fuzz, if I read this article correctly from Science Daily, it looks like there's some DNA replication going on, and there was a variable speed going on that kind of averaged out, if I got that right.
Yes.
Kind of cool stuff going on in the DNA replication world. But tell us more about it.
Well, that Science Daily piece that I sent you is motivated by a paper published in the June 15th issue of the journal Cell by researchers from UC Davis and the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. And they examined the process of DNA replication using what are called single molecule techniques, where they could actually observe DNA replication for individual DNA molecules. And this is really a very important scientific milestone that is shedding important new insight into the process of DNA replication. But it also has some very significant bearing on the creation evolution debate in the case for a creator's role in bringing life into existence. And to kind of set the stage for that, I'd like to tell a little story about when I was in high school. There was a kid that
you're gonna keep it G-rated, right?
Yes, in the spirit of Hugh's acronym, yes.
All right.
But when I was in high school, there was a classmate that we had whose nickname was Radar. And Radar was a special needs kid. He was mentally challenged, but I befriended him. He was a really nice kid, cool kid in many ways, and just the sweetest person in the world. He would just he would never hurt the hair on the head of a fly. Friends with everybody, never a problem in school. But Radar hated going to school, and so he would skip school all the time. And we would eventually show up at school. He would, of course, be summoned into the principal's office. And when the principal asked him, "Well, Radar, where were you at?" he would always say, "Well, I missed school because my grandmother died." And so that was the excuse that he gave.
How many grandmothers do you have?
That's right. So that was the excuse that he gave every time that he skipped school.
His grandpa kept getting remarried, I guess.
So it was this dance that Radar and the principal had about the explanation for Radar's absence. Well, that excuse is very similar to what I hear coming from skeptics and from some scientists when they're confronted with the very powerful evidence for design, is that they always have the same response to that evidence, and it's not a great response. It's not a great rebuttal to the design evidence, and that namely is that the design that we see in biology may be, on some circumstances, appearing to be elegant and impressive, but on the other hand, we see flawed designs in biology, and that those flawed designs undermine the case for design, the case for a creator. And this study illustrates that very point, how these researchers are responding to what I believe to be a very impressive and elegant system in biochemistry, namely DNA replication, as being a flawed system, and why that excuse doesn't work very well, why that excuse doesn't hold up just in the same way that Radar's excuse didn't hold up for skipping school.
All right.
And to appreciate that, we need to, first of all, review the structure of DNA and then give an overview of the process of DNA replication. And I like to think of DNA as being a complex molecule that has a ladder-like architecture. DNA is a large molecule made up of two molecular strands, and each of those molecular strands is made up of smaller subunit molecules that are linked together in a head-to-tail fashion to form that molecular strand. And that strand has a backbone, and it has side groups that extend from the strand at a right angle, and those side groups are interspersed at regular intervals. And when you bring the two strands of DNA together, they form a ladder-like structure that, if you twist, you get this well-known DNA double helix, where the backbones of the strands are like the uprights of the ladder, and the side groups interacting are like the rungs of a ladder. Now, it turns out that there are four subunit molecules that are used to build DNA, abbreviated A, G, C, and T. And it turns out that the sequence of those two molecular strands have a relationship with one another. They are referred to as being complementary strands, because the A subunit on one strand always pairs with the T subunit on the adjacent strand, and the G subunit always pairs with the C subunit on the adjacent strand. And so if you know the sequence of one strand, you know by definition the sequence of the other strand, because of that complementary relationship between the sequences of the two strands. Well, it turns out also that the two strands, even though they align to first approximation in a parallel manner, are actually what biochemists call anti-parallel, because the top of one strand is adjacent to the bottom of the other strand. So in biochemical terminology, one strand goes from 5' prime to 3', prime, and the other strand goes from 3' prime to 5'. Prime. So the strands are in opposite orientation, and that's referred to, again, as being anti-parallel. Well, it turns out when the process of DNA replication takes place, both of those features that we talked about, the complementary relationship of the sequence on the two strands and their anti-parallel nature, plays a huge role in the process of DNA replication. And to think of DNA replication conceptually, what you need to do is think about the two strands separating from each other. And now you have these single-stranded pieces of DNA. And what the cell's machinery does for each of those separated strands is it comes along and it reads them, and it begins to synthesize a new strand wherever there's an A, it introduces a T. Wherever there's a G, it introduces a C, and so on and so forth. And so what you wind up with are two daughter strands, where one of the strands comes from the parent strand, and one is a newly synthesized strand. And the technical term for that is semi-conservative template-directed DNA replication, if you're keeping score at home, so to speak. Now, in real life, when DNA is replicated, you have the double helix that first of all has to be unwound, and then the strands have to be separated from each other. And that process of beginning replication occurs at a specific spot on the DNA sequence or on the DNA molecule called the origin of replication, cleverly enough. And what happens is a protein or an enzyme called helicase binds and begins to unwind the DNA. And as it unwinds the DNA double helix, it creates this structure called a bubble that consists of single-stranded DNA. And that bubble and those single-stranded pieces of DNA serve as the template sequences that are used to assemble the newly synthesized daughter strands. And that replication bubble continues to expand in both directions from the point of origin, so that the bubble gets larger and larger. But as it gets larger and larger, the replication process takes place. Now, it turns out that DNA replication can only occur in a single direction. The enzymes that replicate DNA, which are called DNA polymerases, can only go 5' to 3'. That's the only direction. Well, because the strands are anti-parallel, it means you now have got a little bit of a conundrum on your hand. Because when the replication bubble forms, one strand is in the right orientation, and so it's red and the DNA replication just takes off. That's called the leading strand. The other strand, however, has to wait until the replication bubble grows sufficiently so that DNA replication can begin to take place, and it goes in the opposite direction of the leading strand, but you only make a very short piece of DNA. You have to wait for a little bit more to unwind, then you can make another little piece of DNA, and that process goes on and on. That strand is called the lagging strand, and it's also called discontinuous replication, whereas what's happening on the leading strand is called continuous replication.
Are you talking about whole pieces of DNA, not portions of the ladder rung?
No, yeah, smaller pieces.
Okay.
And these are called Okazaki fragments after the Japanese biochemist that discovered them. Well, the process of replication is even more complicated than I'm presenting,
yeah,
because before replication can begin on the leading strand, you have to lay down a little piece of RNA called a primer. And this is done by a complex called a primosome. And once that little RNA primer is laid down, you then have the DNA polymerase taken over, and away you go on the leading strand, continuous strand replication. But on the lagging strand, each time a little fragment is made, you got to lay down a little piece of RNA. You got to lay down a primer. So you have a little piece of RNA laid down, DNA synthesis happens, it stops, a little bit more of the replication bubble is exposed, another primer is laid down, the next fragment is produced, and on and on and on. And so you've got this process of leading strand, lagging strand, continuous strand, discontinuous strand replication. Now, researchers have long thought, biochemists have long thought, that the DNA polymerases on the two strands were coordinating with each other so that the replication would occur in a rather seamless way. And this is actually very important, because if you don't coordinate the activity of those two DNA polymerases, what will happen is you'll have large portions of the replication bubble with single-stranded DNA being exposed, and that's really a bad thing, because that single-stranded DNA is fragile and it can break, creating damage to the DNA and frustrating and interrupting the DNA replication process. So it's critical that those two processes are coordinated. And so the researchers now wanted to study DNA replication in a single molecule, monitoring what's happening on both the leading and the lagging strands. And what they discovered, to their surprise, was that the leading strand replication didn't happen in a nice, smooth manner, but rather happened in bursts, where suddenly the DNA replication would take off, and then it would pause. And then it would take off again, and it would pause. And each time it started to replicate, the rate of replication could vary by a factor of 10. And so on the lagging strand, again, the process of replication was not coordinated with the leading strand, but they both were happening autonomously without any kind of interaction with one another. It was a highly stochastic, haphazard process that was taking place during replication. And in fact, this was so surprising to the researchers that one of them made this particular comment where he said, it's a real paradigm shift and undermines a great deal of what's in textbooks. Because again, everybody thought that those processes were smooth, highly coordinated processes. Now, it turns out that the fact that people have studied DNA replication using a collection of DNA molecules explains the difference in results. Because even though the process is highly herky-jerky, haphazard, when you average it over a large number of DNA molecules that are being replicated, it looks as if there are nice average rates of replication where it looks as things are coordinated with each other. But for individual molecules, that really is not the case whatsoever. And so the researchers looked at this and concluded that this is a stochastic process. The molecules are behaving in an uncontrolled manner. And when you read between the lines in the paper, it's as if, look, this is really a very poorly designed process because of that lack of coordination that's taking place. However, the researchers discovered a couple of things that are really very interesting. One is that when the leading strand replication is taking place and the DNA polymerase pauses, somehow the helicase knows to pause as well. The helicase will slow down. And then when the DNA polymerase picks up speed, it'll pick up speed starting to unwind the DNA molecule, which means that the replication bubble never gets too large, exposing too much of the single-stranded DNA. And right now it's a mystery as to what's going on to coordinate the helicase unwinding of the DNA to the stopping and the starting of the leading strand polymerase. Another thing that they discovered is that the level of primosome, the copies of the primosome complex, which lays down the RNA primer, actually controls the rate of replication on the lagging strand or the discontinuous strand, where it seems to be exquisitely optimized so that you lay down the right number of RNA primers so that the lagging strand replication is always at pace with what's happening on the leading strand, even though that DNA polymerase is going in a stop and start fashion. And if you had too much primosome, you would gum up the DNA replication process too little, you'd expose too much of single-stranded DNA. So it seems to be just rightly fine-tuned in terms of the composition to ensure lagging strand replication happens in a way that doesn't get outpaced by what's going on the leading strand. So even though this replication process is happening in an autonomous, haphazard, stochastic process, there's actually design built in other ways in the process to ensure that you don't have single-stranded DNA exposed, to ensure that there are compensatory designs to the stochastic behavior of the DNA polymerases. And so it turns out that as a biochemist, I'm actually not surprised that the DNA polymerase molecules are behaving in this haphazard manner. That's how molecules behave. They don't behave in these nice, continuous, smooth trajectories. They behave in a rather haphazard manner. That's just the nature of molecular systems. And so I'm not surprised by that finding. But what is remarkable is how there is these compensatory designs built into the process that actually ensure that, in light of that, DNA replication occurs in a remarkable way that ensures the fidelity and the robustness of the process. So it's as if there's a loss of design in one place, but then the design that's built in to compensate for it is actually to a much greater degree. And so even though there's a tendency to look at DNA replication as being a flawed design. That excuse doesn't hold up as we think about this, the problem in a broader sense. And so often when we present a case for design as Christian apologists, the response is, but what about all the flawed designs? But time and time again, when we look at flawed designs or so-called flawed designs, and we understand the design better, what appears to be a flaw actually turns out to be even more evidence for elegant design. So again, this excuse or this way to sidestep the problems with design for skeptics actually doesn't hold up upon further scrutiny.
Mm. Yeah.
Just a comment. It's a bacterial DNA replication system, right?
Yes. Yeah, they were studying.
Yeah,
this.
And I think that's for any experts that are out there listening. I think that's kind of important to point out because there you have a separate helicase and polymerase function. I think in mammalian replication that the complex is a single complex of helicase and polymerase.
Yeah, and that's really interesting because there is some speculation that there may be protein-protein interactions that are mediating the coordination of the polymerase and the helicase activity. And so if you're looking at mammalian systems where it's one complex, the way around that process where things are stopping and starting on the leading strand would be built into the fact that it's one gigantic complex. So, that difference actually makes sense in light of this design.
Fuzz, what would it take for somebody to say that there are flaws here to really acknowledge then what you're saying?
Well, I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, it's the idea that, you know, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, that you can look at a biochemical system and you can see it as being elegantly designed, or you can look at a system and you can identify things that conceivably could be flawed designs. And usually when people declare a biochemical system or a biological system in general to be flawed in some way, to be poorly designed, it's usually they're usually jumping the gun on drawing that conclusion. Okay, it's a hasty conclusion to conclude a flawed design.
Or a short-sighted comment,
yes,
perhaps. Yeah.
Because it typically doesn't take into account the entirety of the system or everything that we know about the system, or it's a system where we have incomplete understanding. Because for every example I've ever seen where somebody points out that something is a bad design, usually if you drill down and you develop a better understanding of that system, what appears to be a bad design almost always turns out to have an explanation or a rationale, or actually builds upon the
case. A compensatory function or something
like
that.
Yeah, builds upon the case for design.
And this is typically it's a failure to look for other purposes.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or other factors that are
functional. And so this is a prime example where these guys doing this work saw, oh, these things are behaving autonomously. These DNA polymerases are behaving autonomously. It's a haphazard process. They're stopping and starting, and the rates are out of control. And so they immediately conclude, well, this is not really a very nicely designed system. But at the same time, in the same study, they're actually discovering this braking mechanism in the helicase that's slowing things down when the DNA polymerase stops. And they're discovering how the composition of the primosome or the level of the primosome is fine-tuned to ensure that you're producing the RNA primers at the right rate so that the lagging strand replication process doesn't get away from the leading strand replication process. And so they themselves discovered these compensating designs, but yet didn't view those as actually being remarkable whatsoever. They just simply didn't see that, really highlighting the robustness and the remarkable nature of the replication process.
Any comment in the paper, Fuzz, about the variability of the start-stop sequence? In other words, the timing of when it goes from stop to start, stop to start.
No, I mean, it just happens without any kind of pattern. It's completely
Well, part of the variability, I think, would be anticipated from the nature of statistical mechanics that's operating inside the cell. And so you're going to get some variation just from that alone. But I would think if it's significantly different from that, then maybe that would justify some comment as to what's going on.
Well, you know, in response to that, what I'll say is everybody's probably seen by now these really neat computer animations of DNA replication and transcription and things like that on YouTube, right?
Right.
Those animations really should be understood as models,
right,
not as actually what's happening in the cell. They are so misrepresentative in many respects because molecules don't behave that way. They are, again, it's just highly erratic behavior.
Well, you got the Brownian motion operating. So
that's right. And so plus on top of that, there may be sequence elements in the DNA that are much easier for the DNA polymerase to read through and others that are much harder for it to read through. So there may be some slowing down and pausing that are just simply sequence dependent, but it's sequence dependence plus just the way in which molecules behave.
Right.
So it's not surprising that it's behaving that way.
And we know it's not just slowing down and stopping. We know sometimes it slips and it repeats itself, right?
Yeah,
we know
that
all
that stuff is happening. And when it takes off in bursts, but the rate at which it's replicating is not predictable whatsoever. But
Nor would we expect it to be predictable.
Right. But now what's interesting is the rate-limiting step for DNA replication is laying down the primers. Right. And so when you have a short enough fragment that you're making, although they argue that the Okazaki fragments are probably highly variable, even on the lagging strand, but the rate-limiting step is the synthesis of the primer. And so the way you're controlling the replication process on the lagging strand is by controlling the number of primers that are being produced. So you get that optimal number that are produced, which then basically allows you to regulate the rate of what's happening on the lagging strand in such a way that things don't get away from you with regard to the leading strand, lagging strand. So it's a really elegantly coordinated system. It's just that the coordination isn't between the polymerases. It's with other parts of the system.
So Fuzz, the on the lagging strand with the Okazaki fragments, before you can have ligation of the fragments, you have to have removal of that RNA primer too as well. Right.
Right.
And so that's happening through a degradation process that's basically destroying the primer. So it's not like you can cut the primer off and reuse it. You have to you degrade the ones that on the fragments that are already synthesized before you can ligate them.
Right.
And then you have to synthesize new ones every time you want to lay down a new one, right?
Yes.
So there's no recycling.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and to be clear, I mean, these researchers were only focusing on the really what I would consider to be the initial steps in replication. They weren't looking at the removal of the primers and then the
ligation.
Replacement of that RNA with DNA and the ligation and all that good stuff. So yeah, there's much more to the process that you know would be interesting to study with these single molecule techniques. But you know, it's a milestone study, but it just nicely illustrates just two different ways you can look at biochemical systems. You can either see design or you can see flaws, but it's hard, in my view, to justify the flawed view of biochemistry when you really look at everything that's going on.
All right. Great. Thank you for that, Fuzz and Hugh and AJ, all three of you, for exciting discoveries from each of your respective areas of research and discipline. All right. That's going to wrap it up. Great stuff. You can all breathe and go back and give us some more next time. Thank you. And thank you all for listening. To interact with the Scholar team, you know where to reach them on their Facebook and Twitter pages, RTB Official. For Fuzz Rana, Hugh Ross, and AJ Roberts, this is Joe Aguirre. Thank you for your support. We will see you next time on Scientifica.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.